You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hurricane Ida is the latest severe storm to highlight risks to infrastructure in the United States, from washed out roads to flooded subways. We'll talk to an expert to learn more about our infrastructure and what might need to change to adapt during climate change. Now, a Texas law went into effect this week that effectively bans abortions after about 6 weeks into pregnancy. This may be the biggest challenge to the national precedent of Roe v. Wade since the 1973 decision. The court responded this week to an emergency petition aimed at stopping the law from going into effect while it goes through the court system. Justices voted 5-4 not to stand in its way. So that law is in effect now in Texas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how this new law works, who it affects, who it does not affect? What's your response to this law going to into effect and the Supreme Court's decision to not stop it, at least for now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. She's one of the leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in America. Her most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us exactly what this Texas law does?
So this Texas law authorizes literally anyone, the word is any person, other than a state or local official, to bring a lawsuit against anyone who performs an abortion after 6 weeks of into pregnancy, or anyone who aids or abets someone seeking an abortion at that point. And that, of course, is before many people know they're pregnant. This is a variation of laws people may be familiar with, the so-called heartbeat bills. What's different, of course, is that most heartbeat bills criminalize these procedures. Texas creates these lawsuits. And there's kind of, that sounds weird. It sounds weird for a state to say we're going to create a law and then stop our own officials from enforcing it. But there's a kind of a strategy behind the madness.
Can you talk about that strategy? Why approach it in that way?
Well, Texas was hoping to avoid a potential loss in the Supreme Court. So other states that have passed heartbeat bills have occasionally had to pay through the nose, particularly they've had to pay attorney's fees to abortion providers who brought constitutional lawsuits. And so Texas lawmakers had demurred when previously thinking about passing a heartbeat bill, but they decided as an alternative that they would introduce this bill to insulate themselves from liability. So how that works, there's a doctrine called sovereign immunity in U.S. law that limits when you can sue a state. And the exception to that is that you often can sue an official who's enforcing an unconstitutional law. The ingenious thing Texas did was to say, essentially, we've told you no state official can enforce this law, so there's no state official you can sue in federal court. So whether this law is unconstitutional or not, there's nothing you can do about it, at least not in federal court, which is how we've ended up where we are.
So with this enforcement, any private citizen, as I understand it, can say, hey, I think this organization has performed an abortion after 6 weeks, say, and then what happens? It doesn't go into a criminal court, but a civil court?
Yep. And then that person can receive a minimum of $10,000. From the person either performing the abortion, and it's worth saying helping someone get an abortion. It's worth unpacking what the aiding or abetting thing actually means, because that could be, you know, a boyfriend or husband whose partner is sexually assaulted is bringing them to the abortion clinic. That person could get sued. Arguably, you know, that you have to knowingly aid or abet. So anyone who's sort of inadvertently involved may not get sued, but other people, anything from advocacy groups to transportation providers to family members to friends, could all be sued for this minimum of $10,000 as well.
So on a practical level, what's happening in Texas right now with abortion providers?
Abortion providers have announced for the most part that they're not planning on performing procedures after the sixth week of pregnancy anymore because this law is in effect. And beyond that, what's happening is that there's sort of an arms race, if you will, between abortion rights supporters and abortion opponents, where abortion rights supporters are trying to offer options to people outside of the state and to make it easier for people in the state to leave to get those options, whether that's getting abortion medication mailed to them or travel across state lines to get a procedure. And the state is beginning to explore options to shut down those alternatives. So it's kind of a mess now. It's going to be kind of unpredictable. And at the same time, Texas anti-abortion groups have set up websites and other places, tip lines, where you can report people that you think are either performing abortions or aiding or abetting someone who is.
Talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, looking at this law now in effect in Texas, taking a unique approach, in effect stopping abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. As our guest mentioned, often before people know they're pregnant. You can join in with your questions, thoughts, reactions at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Mary, I want to visit now the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't sit and hear the case. They decided in this 5-4 decision to not block this law pending it going up through the court system. Can you talk about that decision and what it means?
Well, so this is part of a kind of weird feature of what the court does that scholars like me call the shadow docket. So most of the time, if you hear about the there's been oral argument, there's been briefing, everything has been done in the light of day, but the court handles these emergency appeals in a very different way. So there's no arguments, there's no briefing. The opinions don't always even have, you know, reasoning, or it's not always clear who's decided what. And that shadow docket's grown exponentially in recent years, and it's grown to include more and more controversial matters like abortion. So the court here isn't saying ultimately that the law is unconstitutional or not, but these kinds of emergency orders still tell us a lot, because the court is supposed to allow a law like this to go into effect only if the justices believe that it's quite likely to be considered constitutional, or at least there's no vehicle for challenging its constitutionality when the case is fully litigated down the line. And so the justices here were hinting that that was what they were going to conclude when the case got to that point.
And as I understand it, Mary, a handful of other states are at least potentially going to pursue almost identical laws to what we're seeing in Texas. Do you expect to see similar laws, especially in Republican-controlled states?
I do. I mean, I think if the Supreme Court is really going to sign off on this business model, I would also expect to see similar laws involving other constitutional rights in more Democratic-controlled states, too. If the Supreme Court is serious that, you know, you can pass a law saying you may have a constitutional right, but people can sue you for $10, and as long as the state doesn't enforce it, it's good. It's not going to stop with abortion, right? I mean, states are going to experiment with everything from, you know, the right to bear arms to vaccine mandates to the right to free speech. I mean, it's not going to, but as already we've seen Arkansas and Florida announce that they're going to pursue legislation like this when it comes to abortion, but I think that's going to just be the tip of the iceberg.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Laura is calling from Illinois. Laura, hello.
Yes, hello. I'm calling basically because I had two illegal abortions before Roe versus Wade. I'm 70 years old now. Those abortions were done, the first one was done by a doctor in a hotel room. I was taken to a hotel room, and that's where it was performed. The other one was done, I was blindfolded in a van with other women, and we were taken to some unknown facility where the abortions were performed. So what I want to say is that women will find a way to have an abortion. We just need it to be safe and legal.
Laura, thank you for sharing your experience with us. Mary, your thoughts on the idea that we might be returning to some of what Laura experienced herself?
I think that's realistic. I mean, the things that have changed in the years since primarily involve the availability of medication abortion. So there are non-governmental organizations that exist primarily to get medication abortion to people in either countries or communities where abortion is illegal. And self-managed abortion, at least the research suggests, is relatively safe if certain protocols are followed. So that said, of course, the experience of women in past years won't completely be gone. And that's particularly going to be true for people who are lower income, more often people of color, who are the ones who disproportionately have abortions at high rates, and also the people who are probably going to have some of the least access to money, to information, and who may try to end their own pregnancies in ways that aren't safe. So hopefully there have been improvements to medical care in the years since that will change the picture some, but I don't think as entirely as we might like.
We're picking up our talk now about the new Texas law effectively banning abortions in the state after 6 weeks. It went into effect this week. Mary Ziegler is with us from the Florida State University College of Law. Her books include Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jess is with us in Genoa. Jess, hi.
Hi. I was just curious, what's to stop someone from accusing one of the legislators who voted for this law, or even the governor of Texas for signing it, of having performed one of these procedures, since it's my word against yours and, you know, not a criminal case? So, you know, I'm just curious.
Interesting. So what does somebody have to establish, Mary, to start this civil process against somebody they allege has performed an abortion, as Jess is saying, whether they've actually done it or not?
Well, we already know that there are people who oppose this law who are kind of trolling legislators. So there's a tip line, as I mentioned, that Texas Right to Life has set up. And what's already happened is that people opposed to the law have been flooding that tip line with exactly what the caller mentioned, like false complaints, arguing that, you know, Governor Greg Abbott is, you know, performing abortions or helping people perform abortions, and claiming that he's helping, you know, Shrek and cartoon characters get abortions. So that's already happening. In terms of what you would need to prove, it really is kind of a he said, she said sort of situation, in the sense that you're not obviously very often going to get direct evidence that an abortion is happening, much less that someone is aiding or abetting somebody seeking abortion. So more often you're probably going to have, you know, allegations that someone, for example, went to Planned Parenthood or was talking about abortion. I mean, it's really incentivizing neighbors to inform on one another to get money, because there's almost a sort of guarantee of $10,000 if you do report, and that's, you know, being put in place at a time when some people are hurting economically.
Thanks a lot for that call. I also wanted to ask about the legal process that could get this law into a full-on U.S. Supreme Court case. What would have to happen to allow someone to challenge this law in the courts that might start that process to get it to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's litigation is continuing in the federal district court. But again, the Texas is arguing that it shouldn't have to be there at all, and that it's immune from suit. And we would expect, based on what's happened so far, that both the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the intermediate appellate court, and the U.S. Supreme Court would accept that argument, because they've accepted it up until this point in the litigation. That said, obviously, there are other challenges that are proceeding in the state courts. And there also can be federal, what are called as applied challenges. So instead of arguing that the law is just unconstitutional across the board, abortion providers who actually do, you know, perform these procedures and get sued could argue that specific lawsuits are unconstitutional. But they'd have to be willing, of course, to perform those abortions and risk the legal liability that that would involve in order to test the law.
Let's go back to our callers now. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hello.
Hello. I am. I don't practice or believe in abortions, but at the same time, I'm pro-choice. Just for this reason, because getting an abortion or, you know, having that procedure done is—it's like you can't really. And it almost reminds me of like the Salem witch trials, because it's something where, what if somebody like accidentally gets a miscarriage or something happens where, but all it takes is for your neighbor to be like, oh, you had an abortion. You're like, what? And then you can get sued, and anybody enabling you can get embedded, you know, that's empowering that can get sued too. To me, it's just, it just reminds me of like the Salem witch trials. There's no way of really proving a lot of this stuff.
Troy, thanks for the call. Mary, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real concern because, I mean, even if you, you know, let's just say you're not even pregnant, right? You're just a person of reproductive age. Somebody could still accuse you of getting an abortion. And even if they can't prove it, you'd have to go to court and deal with all the hassle. And of course, that's going to be even more true of people with pregnancy loss, where that could be like if you have a miscarriage or a stillbirth, where that could be mistaken for an abortion. I think the Salem witch trials comparison is not a bad one because this is incentivizing people to report on their neighbors. And I mean, even worse in some ways, because in the Salem witch trials, we can assume that people were doing that for, you know, for attention or because they were affected in some ways by some kind of health condition. Here, we're really looking instead at people who might just be doing this for the money, right? I mean, each time somebody supposedly aids or abets in an abortion or performs an abortion, that's $10,000. So you could do over and over and over again to make money, and there's no real requirement that you only be actually trying to find people who performed abortions. You may mistakenly they did believe someone aided or abetted. You may not even be sincere. But yeah, all of those are real concerns.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, looking at the new Texas law on abortion. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. You know, statutory rape is a crime, so I'm suggesting a mandatory minimum prison sentence for every statutory rapist where the rape ends up in a live birth. So if a baby is born to a female who was under 18 when she got pregnant and the father was over 18, he gets a mandatory minimum sentence and he can't buy his way out and he can't marry his way out. I'm thinking 18 years is about right. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Chris, thanks for the call. And Mary, exceptions we often hear about in abortion laws for things like statutory rape or rape or incest, are those there in this Texas law?
No, in short. So there's no rape or incest exception. So many of the common exceptions that you would see in an abortion ban are not in this law. And so, you know, if you have, no, for example, just to take an example that's realistic, if you have a child who's sexually assaulted, to use the caller's example, not even statutory rape, let's just take straight up vanilla sexual assault, and you want to take that child, you know, can be like a 12-year-old to get an abortion, you can be sued. That's sort of the reality of the law. Anybody, rape and incest doesn't matter. There's a limited sort of severe health emergency exception. That is very, very narrow, but that's the only thing that really excuses abortions or aiding or abetting abortion under the law.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We'll go next to Sandra in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hi.
Hi. I found a writing from Lance Wilburn, which really sums up everything I'm thinking about. The irony of all abortion bills is a complete lack of male inclusion. Now, when I noticed the governor of Texas in that photo op, I think 80% of the people standing behind him were older white males. Women do not magically become pregnant. There's a man attached to every single abortion. And why are they not being included in the jail time? It's because this really isn't about abortion. It's about men controlling women. It's an easy topic for white men to flex their power over to remind women that they will always be under them. If we were actually about abortion, we would be discussing early and continuing sex ed, free birth control, health care for all, making child care financially feasible, mandatory parental leave, increasing...
Sandra, I'm going to jump in because we don't have much time left, but Mary, your thoughts on Sandra's points.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, because there is, I mean, this law, I guess, does try to be egalitarian in a weird kind of bizarre way by allowing you to sue men if they help their partners get abortions. But generally speaking, I think there isn't really in a lot of these states, certainly in Texas, there's unsurprisingly very high rates of maternal mortality, often in the places that limit access to abortion the most. And that isn't inevitable, right? I mean, you could have a state that did fund things like contraception, sex education, neonatal and maternal care, especially for low-income folks who are going to be at the highest risk for complications. But often that's not how our politics work, and that's often how we end up with policies like this.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Just in our last minute, what are you watching for next as the story goes on?
Well, the Supreme Court has another major abortion case before it that's coming up this term that we should hear about an answer in by the end of the summer of 2022, actually probably early summer 2022, that could spell the end for Roe v. Wade altogether. It involves a Mississippi law that bans abortion at 15 weeks. That violates what Roe says now, which is that you have a right to choose abortion before viability. And so the fact that the court took that case when it had others available to it suggests that this court is ready either to overrule Roe or to take a significant step in that direction. So even before the Texas law gets back to the court, everyone should keep an eye on that Mississippi case.
Mary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. We talked to her today about the new law that went into effect in Texas this week, effectively banning abortions after 6 weeks.